This is Ann Nicholson Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago Interview Podcast. This week, we're talking about sound design. And I'm here with three Chicago sound designers, Ray Nardelli and Joshua Horvath, who are the sound designers for Goodman Theater's production of Tom Stoppard's Rock and Roll, and Nick Keenan, who designed The Piano Lesson by August Wilson, which is currently playing at Court Theater. I wanted to start trying to make this very specific. So Ray and Joshua brought a clip from, do you call it a clip?
Yeah.
What do you say?
Yeah, sure.
A little bit of the sound from Rock and Roll. And we're going to listen to that and talk about it for a little while. And then Nick likewise brought something from The Piano Lesson. We'll talk about that. And then we'll just see what else there is to talk about sound design. So what do we have from Rock and Roll?
This is the opening cue. It sort of set off sort of this rock and roll experience that we want to have the audience encounter.
Tell me what artistic choices went into that. First of all, what were you asked for by the director?
Mm-hmm.
And then, which is Charlie Newell from, mm-hmm. I think of him as Court.
Yeah.
Here he is at Goodman.
Yeah.
And then what did you have to figure out how to do?
Yeah, the artistic choice came from the start of the design conversations. The great thing about Charlie is that he gets all the designers involved. We were probably involved like 6 months before the actual production. And what he really wanted to have at the essence of the beginning of this is get the audience really into sort of that rock concert feel.
Mm.
So at a rock concert, a lot of times, what happens is that house lights just sort of black out. You hear this big sort of chunk, the big sort of bass hit that we had. It's like a big breaker getting turned off.
Right.
So what we did with the lighting designer is that when you heard that big breaker being turned off, the house lights went out, totally out. And then when you have sort of a big, when a concert starts, you're having a big event. And that was sort of that guitar riff, a big sort of guitar strum.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crowd always gets excited about that, so you have a big cheer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in Tom Stoppard's piece, in the actual piece, he's actually had all these songs. They're in the script.
Right.
So that was Golden Hair by Syd Barrett, and
you didn't have any choice about that. You got to start with it.
Had no choice. Yeah.
Right.
But we did choose when to edit it, because
mm-hmm.
we actually made it a little longer than when it's in the script, because we really wanted this event to sort of be parallel to what happens at the top of the second act, and we wanted to take some time to sort of establish this environment. So it was our choice to make it a little longer, to make it a little bit more important, to make it a little bit, there's a lot of effect on that that makes it sort of spacier, you know, because this girl is smoking pot and she's a little high and she's sort of just in, we want to get into her world. So those are the choices we made for that.
So here's a really basic question. Where do you go to get the sound of a crowd cheering at the beginning of a rock concert? Or where did the guitar come from? Where do all these actual pieces of sound come from?
You can...
This is Ray.
Hi. You can purchase, lots of different sound CDs. Like, they're sort of behind us right now. There's actually companies that make libraries of sound effects. And a lot of it's been generated from the film industry and the TV industry. And you basically go, well, is it easier for me to actually just go someplace, in a recording studio, and record it myself? Or should I try to find it, from one of these libraries and pick a couple different sound
effects? So this is like clip art.
Yeah, it kind of is. You can use different crowd sound might be some people clapping, some people cheering, and you mix it all together to sort of fit the moment properly.
And that crowd had about five different crowd sounds in it, five different tracks that I sort of mixed together.
So from different sources, you took them together. Yeah. And why did you use five, or what were you trying to do when you just started with one or two? What weren't you getting that you wanted?
It's the sort of feel, because you want to think of it spatially. Like when you're in an audience, there's some close-up stuff that you hear, but then you also hear a little further away in the depth of it. So you want to add depth to it. We also sort of don't want to be playing the same crowd sound over and over again. We want to make it our own, even though we're taking it from CDs. Mm-hmm. We want to sort of put our own stamp on it. But really thinking about the environment that we put these sound effects in.
So you're imagining how big of an auditorium.
Exactly.
You have to make decisions like that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you didn't have to worry about it being the same size as the actual space we're in. There's nothing goofy hearing something loud.
Not for us. I think it was more about the event.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, as an audience member, does something feel wrong if you're hearing sounds that are too big for the space you're in?
I don't think so in that instance, because we're now taking this journey. Uh-huh. We've now started this journey.
We already know we're in another world. We're not here.
As soon as we hit, because we have this pre-show announcement, which is a big rock pre-show announcement. It's not sort of the standard pre-show announcement that you hear the good one.
This is the turn off your phone one.
Yeah, right? we recorded a new one that had sort of more of a rock feel to it. So it really sort of, and we played the pre-show music a little louder. So we're like, okay, and we had crowd noises in the pre-show music, so you felt like as soon as you walked into the Goodman space, you were actually not in the Goodman space. You were in a different imagined world.
Right. So how do you, one thing that occurs to me after we've had this huge, exciting rock concert sound and then a clip of the song, which, as you said, you extended, now we have to get into a world where the human voice sounds okay. So what do you have to do to make that work?
For this one, it was interesting because we started the sound in sort of our main speakers, which are in the house. And then we faded the sound to back speakers, which were on the back wall of the theater, because our character of Pan was actually back there. So we sort of, what we called sourcing it, we sourced it to Pan. So we brought the level down over about a minute or a minute and a half.
So the sound is going
pulled back
increasingly behind me as I'm sitting in the audience.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So we sort of dropping the level so that we can sort of get accustomed to. But it was a challenge in rock and roll.
Yeah.
Because also the problem with rock and roll is it's a big space and there's not a lot of scenery to sort of reflect for the vocals to actually come out into the house. Mm-hmm. It's just a big open space. Yeah. So we had a little bit of what we call area miking, which we have floor mics down. We put some other area micings around onto the set to sort of amplify it a little bit, but you can't really tell.
But you did not use body mics.
We did not
in
use
this
body
show.
Mics.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
This show is probably unusual in that the music is dictated by the playwright.
It's right. True. Yeah.
And how much did that change what your job was?
I've worked with Charlie Newell for about 10 years. I started running shows at the Court and have designed for him for a long time. And we also did Titus Andronicus with him, which was an all Peter Gabriel soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a whole catalog to choose from.
Right,
William Shakespeare didn't tell us to use Peter Gabriel.
Right.
So we had everything.
Or any particular song.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
uh-huh. We had anything we could do from Peter Gabriel's catalog. So for that one, we had to go through every single song and see if the moments were right. Here we had those choices made for us. But what we did instead is, okay, what is this these bands saying compared to what's happening in the scene or the upcoming scene. Mm-hmm. So then we sort of edited to that, and also we had to sort of fit the transition. How long is it actually going to take that piece of scenery to move on, or how long is it going to take that actor to change into another costume, mm-hmm. or how much time has passed that?
So there's something a little bit ironic that a show like Rock and Roll, which has so much music and mm-hmm. it's about sound, one mm-hmm. whole piece of it, actually you had less degrees of freedom.
Totally.
And kind of yeah. less scope yeah. for artistic expression yeah. than a lot of shows.
It was sort of difficult for us because Charlie and I are both sort of like, let's do whatever we want to do and let's bring all the stuff to rehearsals, because I was in rehearsals for a whole week before we went to tech rehearsals, just playing with timings and stuff like that. And I usually do that with him, and we're just sort of figuring out the palette then. Uh-huh. But we already had the palette
right.
sort of
dictated by
yeah, exactly.
this tyrannical playwright.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen now to Nick's clip, and this is a very different role for the sound designer. The piano lesson, for people who haven't seen it or read it, has a ghost, and the ghost, we don't see anything. Well, there's lighting effects and so forth, but essentially the ghost is in this production, Nick's sound. So let's listen to it and then talk about how you came up with it.
Sure, I'm actually going to play it for you because it's all queued up here. So that probably sounded a little bit different than it did in the theater, but...
So that is from the climax of the show when...
Right, that's what we call the exorcism.
The exorcism. Okay, so you get the call, will you do the piano lesson for us?
Yes,
now
please.
And now you have to make a ghost. And what? How much were you told about by the director about how much, you know, what was wanted, and then... What did you do?
Well, there's actually a lot in the script. August Wilson has some amazing stage directions. For instance, at the sort of end of that entire sequence, he says something like, we hear the sound of wind over two continents. Hmm. And that's sort of like a really evocative sort of stage direction. And he peppers the entire script with those. So that's definitely one of the first starting points. And then Ron Parson, who's the director, who this is my first time working with him, so I'm sort of... as a designer, developing a language with him, and we're sort of getting to know each other as we do this project. He came in with a lot of very specific ideas about sort of using bits and pieces of The Exorcist as inspiration, and those kinds of effects. And then even between those two, it gave me a lot of room to sort of interpret it myself and figure out, well, let's try this and try that. And this was definitely one of those situations where we got to tech and we had one version of it, and then we just totally threw it out. Not quite threw it out, but we added a ton of layers on top of it and really scored every single action with a sound effect. So basically, like, taking a look at the blocking of the scene, we would throw a sound effect onto a particular piece of blocking, and then... Ron and I would kind of like react against each other and sort of it created this finished product in the moment in tech.
Hmm. So did you, well, talk a little bit about your creative process. I mean, you had a few mm-hmm. things that you knew you had to do, The Wind of Two Continents and
right.
something from The Exorcist.
And there's a couple other lines in there. That was definitely, text analysis is the first step for anything. You're sort of, for me, it's about finding, I call it the physics of the world of the play. Like mm-hmm. how does sound, or really even how does the world of the play function? Is it completely naturalistic? Like whatever happens in the real world happens in this play. So, you know, when you have a car go by, you hear every piston firing in the engine, that kind of thing. That's a very time intensive process, and there isn't a lot of dramatic payoff to it mm-hmm. most of the time. Mm-hmm. So we can sometimes sort of like zoom in on the dramatically important pieces of realism. Like it's nighttime, so we hear a kind of cricket.
There were crickets. And it was Pittsburgh, so I was actually confused by that.
Well, there's crickets in the city as well.
I guess that's true.
Right. And that's the other thing, too, is that you're also taking into account at some point what the audience expectations are. Uh-huh. You're dealing with a very specific audience. In this case, this was the first time that I was dealing with the specific court audience, which is I actually had to take the lead on with Ron a lot because Ron knows the court a lot better, and this was my first time working with the court audience, and they're a really intelligent, inquisitive audience, and the preview process is amazing there. They mm-hmm. sort of bring in the audience and say, okay, what did you think? And then we have a real conversation.
All those University of Chicago academics go at it.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
The audience will tend to evaluate sound based on what they know to be true in naturalism. So, like, for instance, the thing that we can kind of get into traps with as sound designers is cooking. Like, when you're cooking something, everybody knows what cooking sounds like, and so they will get really critical if you cut corners. Mm-hmm.
Hear the flame of the gas stove go on or something.
Right. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so the question is, you have to sort of, as a designer, say what is dramatically important? Because if I put the gas stove on in the scene, yes, you may be able to hear it, but is that distracting from what they're saying in the story? And in August Wilson, you have to process
right.
a ton of language. Mm-hmm. And the language is beautiful, and you sort of get immersed in it. And so actually, if you're thinking about dramatic realism, you're often missing detail because
it's not important.
The perspective of mm-hmm. the audience is about
right.
I need to learn this in this moment. And actually, our brains process sound that way, too. We can focus in on particular things that we're interested in and sort of shut out the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we sort of use that as sound designers, too, sort of cueing the audience as to what to focus in on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's stylization, which is just have fun.
Well, go back to your ghost. Did you
sure.
have a mental image of what this ghost was?
I did, and I think I took my cues from a couple lines that I think Lyman says in the script, which is they're talking about the ghost of the yellow dog, the ghosts that haunt this area in the South that suddenly later in the story sort of pop up in Pittsburgh. And he describes them as they kind of sound like the wind. Do they sound like the wind? That kind of thing. So that was the first mm-hmm. cue, is I wanted to make a supernatural sound out of sounds of nature. So I sort of skewed that up through the entire show.
Yeah.
Having breezes of wind coming through the windows at key moments. I actually had a sort of howling wind through a door that would open, and as the door opened and closed, it would sort of return. So it's sort of like a leaky door kind of effect, which is it's a really haunting sound that's mm-hmm. sort of like
unnerving. Yeah.
Right. And then I brought the levels really, really low because we wanted to keep it in sort of a subliminal world.
Okay, but more about this ghost.
Right, more
but
about
you got
this
wind.
So then
there's
the supernatural
accelerating
comes out of those pieces. So
mm-hmm.
the tone of the door became a more Shining-esque sort of pure tone sine wave, which is comes from behind you. The voice of the ghost sort of came out of that breathy wind texture, and the sort of the rustling of the tree leaves sort of became the sound of the voice
yeah.
of the ghost.
Mm.
if that made sense. And so we sort of made it a little bit more human sounding by, you know, playing with microphones and trying to break our voices, really. We did a lot of like late at night and added a bunch of reverb to it.
In order to create the feeling of increasing excitement, I mean, the obvious things are things get louder and they get faster. Is right. there anything else that I don't know about that you use?
There is that sequence. There's, I think, like 50 sounds going on at the same time and at different points. And so that was definitely one. Part of it was just doing it, like creating a rough draft version, seeing how that felt, and then shaping it bit by bit. The things that we were shaping were definitely the volume of those sort of supernatural off-feeling tones, using subwoofer in creative ways. We had actually two very low tones that react against each other, and it sort of gives you this sort of like unsettled stomach feeling.
What do you mean they react against each other? What does that mean?
So it's like it's sort of like a low tone, and then there's one that's a little bit like a half step off of that.
So
they create
dissonant.
A dissonance between them, and dissonance at loud volumes with subwoofers creates this sort of rolling kind of feeling in the space.
Because the sine waves aren't lining up, and then they do, and then they don't, right?
Yeah,
that's what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. So, just so I understand, are you performing The Ghost every night? It's not pre-recorded?
Yes, we are. It's not a pre-recorded sound. I'm not performing in terms of the vocal effects.
No, I just meant that you're essentially putting things together, extemporizing.
It is 27 cues that happen in sequence, because a lot of the stuff, there's one sequence where Boy Willie is sort of stumbling around, and he gets slammed by the ghost against a door and choked. Mm-hmm. And so that has to be very precisely timed.
So he's not timing to your sounds. Your sounds are timing to him.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so it's a lot of visual cues. Every time they throw holy water on an object, it sort of has this sort of sparking sizzle sound that then also has a ghost effect that sort of flies out of that, because it's like the ghost suddenly unable to latch onto objects. In the world of the physics of the play, they're trying to pull the ghost out of the piano. And so every time they throw holy water on the piano, it reacts and is taken off guard, but then gets angrier.
Uh-huh.
And so it goes into the kitchen and starts shaking the kitchen around, and we had a couple set effects to go with those sort of like bouncing plates where the cabinets fly open with nobody doing it, that kind of thing. Boy Willie actually starts closing cabinets. And
so just so that I can picture what you're doing, you're sitting at a keyboard, and right. there are each little bit of sound is there waiting for you and has a command that says, right. Now play this. Is that right?
Most of the shows that we're doing nowadays are all computer playback.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually getting to the point where sound is like lighting, in that you have control over sequences with a go button. So you'll program a sequence of sounds together, which basically gives information about, this is the sound file that you're playing. The sound file is going to be playing through these speakers at this level, and this is the timing of that fade up or fade down and that kind of thing. And all of those things together mean that you can create sort of three-dimensional layered sound effects that all get cued off of stage action.
So in terms of the timing of it, though, Q1 or Q15 has to be able to go for longer than you're likely to use it,
yes.
because what if action gets hung up? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Exactly. So if Boy Willie slips and can't get his feet under him for that moment, the stage manager will actually hold until he's ready. And then as soon as there's for almost all of these visual cues, the actors and stage manager are always having sort of a dialogue with each other. And there's sometimes like a hand motion or something like that that will cue the stage manager to say, okay, the actor's ready for me to take this effect now.
So there's an intermediary, the stage manager. See, I didn't even know that.
There's a sound engineer who's actually physically running the sound, and then the stage manager is sort of managing the timing of everything.
Because there's a lot of times there's lighting cues and sound cues that go together, and that's why we sort of have the stage manager say, he can call all these cues together or separately, so that there's not like five people
all deciding when the moment is.
You have one person sort of unifying.
The master coordinator.
That's how they do it in Europe.
Yeah. But everybody died.
Like, as we found out, everybody sort of
we're
like,
we're the democracy.
but in the American system, uh-huh. The stage manager sort of...
It's the emperor of it all.
Exactly. Keeps it going.
Yeah, they're the one person that keep everyone in sync.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of the tech process is us communicating between the director and the stage manager and making sure that the stage manager is going to be capable of sometimes physically seeing the action that they need to take a visual off of.
Right. Well, that's all very interesting, and it just goes to show the depth of ignorance of your audiences, because I see a lot of theater, and I had no idea
I think it's true that Americans don't necessarily process entertainment sonically. Mm-hmm. They process it visually. So there's a lot of attention that's paid to visual elements in films and theater. And the sound we sort of process subliminally. It's there. It's really important. You can definitely tell when it's missing. But it's. I think that conversation is sort of emerging now.
Obviously, the fact that we're used to film, which has more, much more sound. I mean, a soundtrack, by and large, is not so much part of theater. But it seems like we're moving more and more that direction. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I also think because we're sound designers of a certain generation, like my sound design, I'm very cinematic with my sound designs.
And what does that mean to you?
It means it's very lush and dense with sound.
It means a lot of sound.
Yeah, a lot. And especially as a composer, too. Mm-hmm. We do sort of lush compositions that are very orchestral. And just because of my background of, I didn't really do theater until I went to college. And so what I knew was film.
So when you were four, you were working on film, right?
But no, it's what I noticed, you know. And we also grew up in the age of the blockbuster, you know, the 70s
big
and
80s. Scores,
big scores,
right.
Big, you know.
Yeah,
sort of
we also grew up with using the personal computer.
Yeah.
And that being available to the average consumer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the personal computer in the past 10 years has radically changed how sound designers work in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before then, you know, I can remember bringing a laptop to the tech table in tech and being able to make changes by the director's, you know, request in real time. And everyone was like, what are you doing?
Whoa.
You know, they were just flabbergasted.
Because before then it was all such a pre-recorded.
If you had to make a change, you had to at the old, like for example, the old Goodman, they were one of the few theaters that had a recording studio, a little recording studio. So you'd be like, okay, I got to edit this music. You run down the hallway to an office. You know they had you know a computer. You make the edit. You know, and this was like, you know, wow, you can edit on a computer. But then you still had to put it out onto a reel-to-reel, a reel-to-reel tape, and then they'd run it upstairs to the booth. And put it on a reel-to-reel and then play it.
There's a whole complicated system of reel-to-reel machines. Didn't you have like 8 or something like that were all going at the same time?
We had, because I used to be the soundboard op at the Goodman years ago, we had 3 reel-to-reel machines. And I can remember doing like, if you had to do a complex show, you had like 3 reel-to-reel machines and a CD player and 2 mini disc players and a little, I think called a sampler, which could play short sounds. And it was just, it was...
Like
it was
one
as fast
band.
As your hands could move on the mixer to do a sound design.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I just remember like practicing over and over and over again these complicated segments, but now the computer has changed.
Yeah. Go.
Yeah.
It's
go.
Yeah. Yeah, go. It's a space bar or a button.
Uh-huh.
And there's sort of a younger generation of theater goers and an older generation of theater goers, and they have a very different relationship to silence.
Mm-hmm.
The people that sort of grew up our age, really your age and younger, all grew up with MTV and a ton of sound in our lives. And so silence is much, much more disturbing than it is to an older generation who demands silence. And when they hear underscore underneath a vocal a section, they have a violent reaction to it too.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing how violent the reactions get to sound in different ways. And it's a really interesting thing to see sort of play out.
Well, one thing it clearly brings into question, once you have a lot of amplified sound, artificial sound, the human voice just naked sounds very different. It's sort of almost like from a different world.
Yeah.
So how do you – I mean, we talked a little bit about that, but how do you mediate that? And are there shows where, as a sound designer, you say, you know, I don't want any sound. I want the human voice. Or, I mean, what, you know
– Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Talk about.
Yeah. a lot.
We hate miking people.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of technical issues with miking people, but there's also aesthetic issues about miking people.
Yeah.
And the thought behind it, there's some sound designers who think, looking at New York, everything on Broadway is mic'd. Right. It's a straight play or a musical.
And those are small houses.
Small houses.
It's not like The Goodman.
Yeah. But there's also people are getting used to television and film and how they sound and how you can sit in your home and have your surround sound and mm-hmm. you have the vocal, the text right in your face.
Right.
You know, there's no depth to it and people are used to that and people demand that, you know. There's a lot of sound designers, especially I think in Chicago, who are fighting that and a lot of directors too, who are like, no amplification, even for some musicals. I know The Court, we do very little amplification for our musicals.
It's really hard because really every musical for a very long time, the score and the arrangements have been written with that
in mind. Yeah.
They know that they're going to be wearing wireless mics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put a trumpet, a brass line right on top of that vocal line.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you're saying there's a split kind of in Chicago versus New York? There's a different culture
There's a different aesthetic.
There's definitely a different aesthetic, not only with musicals, but also with the sound design. I feel that because I've done a couple shows in New York and here in Chicago, I feel more with collaborative team as an artist. And New York, because it's more about the musical there, you're not sort of thought about the artist. You're thought as a technician more than anything else.
Give me this, and this.
Mm-hmm. And here, because of people like Rob Milburn and Mike Bodine and Andre Plouse, those guys who've sort of set the path for us as artists, we now can have a dialogue with everybody. We get called into the room at the same time instead of like the day before we have tech rehearsals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so there's definitely – and it's expanding into different regions. You know, I mean, New York's catching up right now. But every time I go into like a place like Kansas City.
Wait, go back. Did you just say that New York is being influenced by Chicago?
Yeah, I was going to say that. I'll say that in every way. I mean, in theater right now, I mean, if you look at New York, what's happening in New York?
Who's getting Tony Awards?
Exactly,
right,
and Obie Awards and stuff like that. It's all Chicago people. You know?
Right.
I think we're in a great time for Chicago theaters right now.
Mm-hmm. A great deal of that also has to do with just New York is thought as, you know, in this country, as the capital, the theater capital.
Especially,
but there's a lot more commercial productions there, and when you're doing commercial productions, you have big, you have big budgets, and you're putting on a lot, bigger productions, and, a lot of that is required to have, big sound.
Right.
You got big sets, big lights, big costumes.
Where did our $100 go? Everybody wants to know.
Yeah, I mean, and it's part of that is just they want to be taken on a thrill ride, And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No.
It's just that's
a different
choice. It's just a lot more large producing theater there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is very interesting. I hope you all stay in Chicago.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks very much.
Yeah,
thanks. Thank you.